Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tullist, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Call Me Malcolm formed in 2011 in the UK, originally as a studio project. It later turned into a live band, and as members changed and as everyone got more comfortable, they truly became an original, incredible band. They are part of a new wave of really talented, musically diverse ska bands in England right now. On March 1st, they released their fourth LP, Echoes and Ghosts. It's their first with Bad Time Records. We brought them on to talk about their music, the scene in the UK that they're part of, and to see how they intersect with the current US ska scene. Many of the new US ska bands have gone over to the UK in recent years, and later this year, Call Me Malcolm will be making their first trek to the States. And now joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of Omnigon and Link 80.
I've always been a big proponent of the UK scene. When I was going over there with Link 80, it was the household name records scene.
Yeah.
But now there's like a whole new crop of bands, and some of those bands grew up going to those shows.
Yeah, so we did, last year we had Popes of Chilitown, that band is part of the scene. We had Pook on, I think it was a year or two before that, and he's part of the scene as well. Lots of bands.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of crossover. Like, there's still some bands that are around, like Lightyear and Sonic Boom 6. I think one of the coolest things about the UK scene is just the way that they put their spin on the music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's similar influences that you see in bands here, but they also have other stuff, like very distinctly like British subgenres of music that kind of seep into the ska.
There's a lot of different influences in the mix with UK bands. Call Me Malcolm seemed to lean heavier in the ska punk side of the scene, but they do it in a totally unique way.
I think a good place to start would be the song / video for Dead Men Take No Pills. Well, actually, let's talk about the video itself first, because it's a pretty epic video. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. First off, the person that shot the video is Andy B, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Correct.
Was this Andy's concept, or was he just kind of helping out?
No. We knew we were going to shoot all three of our single videos with Andy, but at that point in time when we it got fairly late in the day, and we hadn't nailed down all three concepts for the video, and basically our bass player got married and we were on our way back. It was a long drive back home the next day, feeling the after effects of a bandmate's wedding.
I can't stress how hungover we were.
And we just got talking, and as we do on the long car journeys, things got sillier and sillier, and then eventually we concluded that shooting something with puppets would be amazing fun. But yeah, it was a hungover idea that got out of hand pretty quick.
So is there somebody involved with the video that has worked with puppets before? Because it looks
professional enough that it seems like you have an actual puppeteer involved.
Bless you. Bless you for saying that. No, not at all.
We've just got silly ideas and a can-do attitude. And I mean, Andy's a pro. So whatever we gave him, he was going to try and make look pro, because he I don't think he'd be comfortable putting his name to something where that went hideously wrong. But yeah, no, thank you for the kind words.
Well, who made the puppets?
Well, that was a guy on Etsy, and actually, again, just kind of the idea got stupider and stupider in the car as we were driving back, and then it kind of started with I'll go on Amazon and just see what there is, and then there were just these kind of very generic kind of puppets and stuff, and I thought, oh no, I'll just let's go and have a sort of search around some other places, and then I sort of went on Etsy and. You know when your hangover just needs like one specific thing, like a food or a drink or something? Like the thing that took my hangover away was just this picture of this puppet, which Luke will attest to this as well. Genuinely, I laughed for 2.5 hours just every time I just felt a bit sad. I just looked at the picture. And it was this guy in Canada just shipped them over to us. And
I didn't see the puppets for ages. I just had this I was focusing on the road because I was driving home, and I just had this guy next to me cackling for hours.
I should stress I'm an adult, please. Please, I am actually an adult, man.
I mean, these are nice puppets. These aren't like sock puppets or something. Like, you guys must have had like a puppet budget for this.
I mean, we almost didn't. You got to explain this one, Mark. But we almost didn't have the puppets.
Yeah,
at all for the day we were going to shoot. We almost didn't have them.
Yeah, I ended up having to sort of become quite involved in my local postal network to actually get them, which then involved like me getting other band members to go and meet people, whilst also me liaising with the warehouse manager of the post office to like make sure they just like absolutely gave us our parcel. But yeah, I mean, sorry, to answer your other question, yeah, the guy in Canada like makes them all bespoke, and they're all like. He's got like loads of different designs, and the guy's incredible. So, Luke, you found me a video the other day of somebody else had like something completely different. Someone had used exactly the same like style of puppet. I was like, what are the odds?
It's an Instagram reel.
What was the content? What were the puppets doing?
It was something far more offensive than we did. I can't. He was saying very, very adult things, this puppet. I wasn't comfortable.
So this puppet guy in Canada, did you explain to him what you're using them for? Have you sent him the video? Or
I haven't yet, actually. I probably should do that, actually. That's a really good point. Yeah, he's I did message him initially, and kind of I did explain what they were for. So the guy had like an awareness, like at some point, that he was about to become part of the ska punk world. But
and was he happy about that?
Yeah. Well, I didn't send me anything back. I don't know. I don't know why he wasn't so pleased about that. Would you like to be part of a really sort of niche subgenre of music? I don't know why I wouldn't want to be part of that. So
so you have the main puppets for the majority of the video, and then the end you have puppets for you guys. Were those like ones he already had, or did you like have those specifically tailored to match your features?
The puppets with like hats and like everything on, and
yeah, the ones that are like the human one at the end, yeah.
Oh, the police puppets.
Yeah.
Oh no, they were. That's it. That comes in like a cookie cutter, like one police officer. We bought loads of fake like stick on mustaches, so I was off camera like making eyebrows and mustaches and facial hair for these puppets. We had two of the police puppets because we had one scene they were going to be together, but we had different police like characters in this prison, so I was just doing anything I could with fake mustaches to make them look different from the last puppet, which was the same puppet.
I think it was also so because I think again Luke had to kind of step in on the no limit budget that I had to just buy puppets, and I think you could have ended up with me owning roughly 50 police puppets if we weren't careful. Luke was like, no, I'm fairly sure we could just do this with some fake mustaches. Can you please stop buying puppets?
There's a little intervention there.
I'd forgotten, because I'd completely forgotten about the police officer puppets, by the way. So when you said the human puppets at the end, I did think for a second, he does know that was us, right? We were playing our instruments.
They're just tiny toy instruments. Yeah. The people are real, the instruments are fake.
That was genuinely like on the video shoot was a really serious conversation. Like several band members came up to me like at the beginning of the day and they went, just so we're clear, like we are playing the last bit with the toy instruments. It's like, yeah, well, yeah, I haven't really thought about it that much. And they're like, no, I'm going to step in here. Like, we are playing with the toy instruments. Like, they were like, I've never seen so many people with, like, that was their deal breaker. I was like, you guys need some higher standards for this band. You really do.
So now, okay, the song, the content of the song is not silly. It's a pretty big contrast to what, like, visually we're getting on the screen.
Yeah, I like to do that with songs, not necessarily with videos. This was just the right video to do it with. Like on the last couple of albums we've done, generally speaking, the happiest sounding songs, like the kind of most sort of upbeat sounding, are the ones that go to the darkest places. Because it just something feels right about doing that with I don't know, it's kind of you have an opportunity with ska punk because of the vibe and the brass and everything. You can really disguise if your lyrics go to those kind of dark places, like you can disguise what you're doing, not to trick people necessarily. I just like the juxtaposition between the two kind of things. And because this song I mean the whole album goes to some pretty dark places, but this one kind of sat up as the crux of the story on the album, you know, being about whether you do or don't take medication, and that kind of war that I was having in my head. And so naturally when we came up with the idea for the puppets, I can't remember, Mark, did we know that the puppets were going to be for Dead Men, or did we come up with the idea and then go, well, that's got to be that song afterwards? I can't remember.
No, because we already had, yeah, no, we did know it was going to be for Dead Men, because because we had the One Cure video. Well, I think I had already bought all of the stuff to smash from charity shop for the first one, and so most of that video was kind of planned out. You know, I was quite keen. I was sort of thinking, I was like, you are still going to let me smash some stuff though, right? Like, that's still going to happen, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, do you want to speak on it a little more? Like, there's a line from that song that says, you know, the drugs covered up what the world blew up, for instance.
Yeah. yeah. It's this. I didn't necessarily know we'd be going to some super dark places tonight.
We're going from puppets to there's some real talk right now.
Yeah, there was, well, there's this whole thing I've got friends that have been or are on medication, and I know that there's this kind of balancing act you play with it. When you're on the right dose, it really helps, but then if there's too much, it can turn you into a zombie. And that was kind of playing on my mind as I was writing it. And actually, I mean, I should have led with this. I was wrestling with whether or not to take medication. I mean, it'd been on my mind for a couple of years, maybe. Made the decision to do it after a particularly nasty, like, few weeks, months kind of thing. And I'd actually started taking it, and the side effects of the medication at the time would just not let me sleep at all. So Dead Men was written, which in one, pretty much in one hit, So one like sit down at the computer, which is super, super rare for the lyrics when I do them. It normally takes like loads of kind of rewrites. Mm-hmm. But I did it in one hit, and it was written between the hours of like 1 and 3 in the morning, where I just couldn't, like, I was absolutely wired. And so this whole kind of back and forth in my head. I'm sorry this has gone so serious, by the way, but
oh, that's what we're here for.
We should talk about mozzarella sticks.
No.
So yeah, the drugs cover up the world blew up. Like, it was kind of a double meaning, I guess. On the one hand, drugs can they can kind of zombify you if it's wrong, but my hope when I wrote this on, my hope was that it would cover up the kind of the broken brain, for want of a better way of describing it, you know. That's what that, yeah, and that lyric itself is referring back to that one of the first lyrics in the song, which is like the bed covers up what the world blew up, which was a reference to one of the first times I broke down, where I just lay in bed for a day and it didn't feel like a really weird thing, and then I told a friend and they were like, that's not normal. So, you know, and that's that sparked pretty much the Broken album, that episode. Anyway, enough about me, how are you?
you know why we're here, right?
Well, I just want to I'm gonna read what you said to Brooklyn Vegan about the album as a whole.
Yeah.
And you called it a eulogy for the parts of myself I killed with medication, and a love letter to the silhouette I became. So I'm just curious if you can expand upon that, like, kind of reading the lyrics and reading that quote. My assumption, my takeaway was, especially knowing, you know, that you've kind of talked about your mental health issues over the years, to me, it sounds like you were having a bad experience with medication.
No, the short answer is no, not really. I think that we had, like, in all the discussions for the artwork and stuff for this, actually, like, Mark Bell, the artist that did all the single covers, the album cover, the t-shirts, like everything. He's absolute genius. But we had this whole back and forth. We never wanted to present medication in and of itself as bad, or actually in and of itself good. Like, from my perspective, it's part of a whole, like, it's a tool. It's all it is. It's a tool. It's going to work for some people. It's not going to work for others, but it needs to be used like as part of a toolkit, I guess. But what I felt, I mean, that parts of myself are killed with medication. I'm not necessarily talking about bad parts or good parts, but a lot of like the first 6 months of me being on it, which is when like all these tracks got written. Because I'd been, you know, I'd had mental health issues for, you know, like 25 years or so, 25 years since teens, early teens. I mean, that's such a long time, and suddenly my brain was wired differently, and I was trying to figure out what the parts of me that weren't there anymore, like figuring out what the broken bits were by their very absence, as opposed to, it's quite a hard thing to kind of describe, but like that's what I mean. Like the parts of me that I killed with medication were hopefully saying goodbye to the bad bits. And the silhouette I became, silhouette was a particular word choice, because I didn't necessarily want to say, it's not that, again, this is this whole like it's neither good nor bad, but I didn't want to suddenly say like, okay, I've killed all the bad bits and now I'm this halo of good health and you know, positivity and stuff. It's not like that, and life isn't like that. So I'm a different person to who I was before. And silhouette, I think, was just a more poetic way of a more gray area way of saying it than than, hey, look at me, like I'm all smiles now, because it just it isn't like that. But it is a wild, wild ride.
Was this your first time in your experience with dealing with your mental health where you decided to give medication a try?
Yeah. Okay. It was. Wow. This is why to me it was a kind of profound enough experience to tuck in and sure. get 10 songs out of it. But first time, I mean, I'd done various bits of like CBT and kind of personal care and stuff before. I developed a lot of the other tools in my kit, but I'd never gone down that road, although I knew the road was, I think part of it was just the denial, if I'm honest, like,
mm-hmm.
because I'd never be broken. I'd never been broken like forever. Like my depressive episodes or, you know, panic attacks wouldn't last forever. And so when you're on a high, you kind of think, well, I don't need that stuff. That's fine. And then when you're in a crushing low, that's not necessarily the time to it wasn't for me anyway. I thought, oh, it's fine, it'll pass, I'll be better. And I just pushed it to one side and further and further back until eventually I realized that the issues that I'd been having for years and years and years and years and years and years were not normal. I mean, I've discovered some wild stuff about my brain in the last couple of years.
I was going to say as well, like, I do remember like one of the journeys. We were in the van, and I can't remember whether it was driving to practice or a gig, but you were talking about this was kind of like so. I think when we'd written songs and things like that, and you had been taking the meds for a while, and you were talking about something about, I can't remember what it was. It was like you talk about something and sort of saying, oh, it's making me feel really anxious, and it's really like annoying me because it's making me feel more anxious because I'm like taking the meds and I'm now not worried. I'm worried that they're not working. And I was kind of sort of saying, I mean, being anxious is still like a normal human emotion. You're allowed to have that, right? Like, you understand that? Like, it's just like, it doesn't have to be really loud. But yeah, we talk quite a lot about stuff like that in the van, and just I ended up sort of sharing a story with you of like something that kind of like ate me up for like 2 weeks after it happened. That was like the other person clearly thought was like nothing, but I thought was significant. And it was a very interesting conversation. It's been a very interesting conversation, kind of listening to you unpick those bits, I suppose. Like,
that's like figuring out what's normal and what's not. Hey, do other humans feel these things? Like,
so I imagine, like, you know, you felt like, you know, it comes and goes, but then after, you know, 20 plus years, you also acknowledge, like, well, it's cyclic, and the cycle keeps going. So the cycle will continue to go, you know, like maybe that was some of the thought process, like, yes, it comes and goes, but the cycle kind of continues and continues and continues.
Yeah, for sure. I think I recognized, like, I mean, the thing that preceded this one, I had a breakdown that made the one that inspired the Broken album look like I was a fully functional human being. Like, it was a bad breakdown I had that preceded this, and I just thought, like, enough's enough. I need to do something. I clearly need to do something else that is not what I'm, what I have been doing. But my therapist was really good, really great about it, because we'd been talking for a while, and I said, hey, I kind of wanted to ask about medication. Do you think it's a good idea? And she deliberately she never brings up medication with clients. It's always for them to bring up first, which I think is really smart. And once I'd brought it up, she said, okay, now you've mentioned it, I can talk about it. And I've got to say, yeah, I think it's worth a shot.
sure. Yeah.
I mean, maybe you should have led with that, Luke, but, here we are, one album later.
Yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Let's go back to the beginning of the band, and then we'll circle back to this new album.
Oh, but we were so bad at the beginning.
Oh, you don't, I was going to say, you don't, I could log off for a bit. Do you want me to go? That's great.
Were you not in the band That's at great. The beginning?
No. Yeah. I can go and have a tea break. That's great. Don't worry. Right, well, Luke, do you want to ring me when the good bit starts?
When did the band form? I know your first release was 2011, but I couldn't find like a specific formation date.
No, that was it. We were born in a studio. We were in a previous band. Lewis, the trombone player. We were in a previous band, and we had some studio time booked. And then, like a couple of weeks before we were due in, the guitarist quit.
What was this? Okay, previous band was called.
Come Back From Kenya. because the drummer at the time had moved to Kenya, and so we named it in honor of him. He was going to come we were trying to convince him to come back, and I thought the futile gesture of naming a band after him would bring him back, and he did come back
so it worked.
To record. Well, he came back temporarily to record an EP that we'd written with this studio time. This was with Oz as well, our producer, who's done like the last few albums. So he was due to come back, and then, as I say, the guitarist quit, and me and Lewis are like, "Well, we don't have a drummer. We've got a drummer back from Kenya for like a day." I should stress, he was back in the UK for longer. You don't come back again for like a day. But we only had him for a day. Right. And we were just like, what the fuck do we do? Like, we're not a band anymore. We can't record these other songs that we'd written. And I had, the two of us had previously written Does My Offbeat Look Big In This, which is the first track off the first EP. And Lewis had written Tally Man, and I'd had like this old, on an old PlayStation 1, I'd written a really stupid song that had some brass in it. And I was like, we could just play that with a full band. And so we did. With like 2 weeks notice, we taught the drummer the songs, and I played bass on that first EP. And Trev, our current bass player, who I went to school with and played in big band with, he plays an absolutely mean trumpet. So he played trumpet on that album, on that EP as well. So, like I said, we were kind of born out of desperation in the studio. And the EP sounds great. And we thought, hey, we've got a band. And then we sort of did nothing of any consequence until this guy joined.
Wait, so on the PlayStation 1, really quick, what did you use to record that song?
Music 2000.
Explain to listeners what that is.
A very old PlayStation game. It's kind of like, it's like a digital audio workstation for 10-year-olds.
Yes.
Yeah. It's got like a limited amount of samples and like the drums, the guitar. I mean, everything sounds like you would imagine it does on PlayStation 1.
Yes.
Like, however many, yeah. It was bad. The worst thing about that game, I mean, it kept me entertained for hours and hours and hours, but the worst thing I found about it was that it had such terrible memory, like working memory for a song. You'd be creating these monster jams, you'd be a minute and a half into the song and it'd be like, nah, can't use any more samples. So you could only work with what you'd put into that session. So like things ended up getting like really repetitive and stuff. But if you were creative.
That's why we're really good at getting verses and choruses, but middle eights are really hard work.
Got to the middle eight, got nothing.
The only reason I know what that is at all is from touring in the UK and playing with that at somebody's house.
Oh shit, really?
Like, I don't think that it really caught on here, but I think it was kind of big in the UK.
As in the music games.
Yeah.
You guys must have had something over there.
We must have, but I only remember seeing it over there. So hearing you guys talk about it is kind of amazing. I remember it had really horrible like vocal samples in it.
Oh yeah. Absolutely terrible. And the
the one that I remember was closely followed by a black sedan. Somebody sings that in like a weird way.
Most oddly enough, oh my god, I still remember the original ones I put on the track when I'd written it. It must have been in like 2000 and crumbs. I was at university. It was about 2001 that I wrote it. The track "Call Me Malcolm" on the first EP, on the Jexels EP. So that was written in Music 2000. But the vocal bits that we did in the studio, that was just me having some fun. The original samples were like, what the one I remember is just the guy going, "Lost my mind, mine, 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 mine." And that was the verse. It was just,
yeah.
It's a kind of a strange sensation.
I mean, that was the amazing thing about that song is you couldn't import your own audio. You had to just use whatever was in there.
Yeah. Oh man, I lost hours and hours on that.
So Mark, when did you join the band?
Not soon enough.
Yeah, I think once they turned off the PlayStation 1s and we started sort of writing music with real instruments, I think was when I sort of decided to step in. Well, so I started, I don't know the year. I really wish I knew the year, but probably...
I want to say it was 2013.
Yeah, it's something like that. 2013, 2014, like kind of time. Because originally, first album, we did this to ourselves. We just wrote a bunch of harmony parts for me, basically. Well, all of the stuff that they played on the EP stuff, they wrote a bunch of harmony parts for me. And kind of started with them. I think you guys just like, I can't remember who it was. Like, one of the guys was really adamant about no one else joining the band, which I think was our drummer Baxter. Was just like, no one else joins. This is it. Like, and now he's like one of my best friends in the whole world. But like, it's at the time he was just like, no, I don't care who he is. He's not joining. I'm not having this. And we did a bunch of harmony parts for it all, and then I sort of played. I think I played like a Christmas gig or two or something, and then But I do, one of my like residing memories was like going to practice and after playing a couple of songs, like Lewis, who is was my friend long before like joining the band, just kind of turned to me and just went, "You're not actually that bad." I was like, ever get a compliment that's just like shrouded in insult? I'm like, thanks, dude. Thanks. I really appreciate that. It's 2013, I guess, like, and 2013, and then we just kind of started just going out and just like, I think Luke and I are really good at pushing each other. Like, I think it feels like a game of like us just goading each other into, well, no, I bet you can be more committed to the band. No, I bet you can. Like, and just pushing each other like that more and more. Like, what do you want to do next? Like, what thing do you want to achieve next? And like,
any shit we've managed to do in the band has basically resulted as a game of this decade long game of chicken
I'm not going to back out. No, you can back out first. No, 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 fine. All right, well, fine. We're touring the US then. Fine.
I have one question about the first record. The first record, we did this to ourselves, 2014. Why is John Feldman going to kill you?
Well,
I think legally you have to answer this now.
Traditionally, historically, my songwriting was less involved and didn't have as many rewrites, and importantly, checking that I wasn't plagiarizing anything. And on a couple of, I don't want to say numerous occasions, but it probably is. In bands prior to Malcolm, I'd written something and it had been a lawsuit, a 3-minute lawsuit waiting to happen. Importantly, actually, one of them was in Comeback from Kenya. Like, it was just it was a stone cold ripoff of a Goldfinger song, and that it was. So John Feldman's Gonna Kill Me were originally started as just kind of an in joke about the fact that I'd ripped off a ton of Goldfinger songs.
Yeah.
But then the joke of the song is that, like, we reference a load of Goldfinger songs in it as well. And
the end of the brass line or something is like the very last three notes of the Superman solo as well. I think there's like something
we do. Yeah. Baxter does the role, the Superman role. Lou does, I think it's the Answers solo off the first Goldfinger record.
Sorry, yes, yeah, no,
he does
sorry.
This. He steals the end of the solo, and then I steal a bunch of references in the lyrics and stuff. It's been a while since I've heard that song, actually. I try to forget about that record.
For legal reasons, we are going to use the word homage. Homage.
Homage.
So the next record you do, the next full length you do is I was Broken When I Got Here.
Yeah.
And this is 2018. Now, okay, I feel like this record... Now, from my perspective, this record sort of marks the sound that you guys have now. Like, you guys sound on this record and the next two records, you sound very much in the same vein of yourself. I think some of the earlier stuff sounds a little different, but you kind of have developed all of the tools that you use to write songs. Do you agree with that? Was there anything that happened in between those records that might have, like, refined your songwriting style or your performance style?
Bless you, Aaron, for even being aware of anything pre 2018.
He does his research.
Yeah, I just it's really refreshing because I've lost count of the amount of times that, like, when the last album came out, when Me, Myself, and Something Else came out, you know, in publications they were saying, "Call Me Malcolm's second record," and we're like, "Well, thank fuck they don't know about the first one."
I feel like the sound that you have that's on the new record.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can hear it on this record. I don't hear it as much in the earlier stuff. That's what I'm saying.
I think, yeah, no, for sure. You are absolutely right. I think that's down to a bunch of reasons. To be honest with you. I'm gonna let Mark put his incorrect theories forward first, and then I'll correct
them. Oh man, yeah. I should sort of stress as well, quite a lot of my role in the band is saying stuff so that everyone could go, "No, we're definitely not doing that," or "That's wrong," and then just making people do stuff, because otherwise I would just, like, I'd ruin it all. If I'm honest, I mean, we wrote differently on that record. I think, like, we've learned how to do it better with each record that has gone on, but we spent loads of time, probably too much time, I think, like, certainly for the first time around, where I don't think we knew that what we were also doing at the same time was developing kind of how to work together, like how to write together. But we would, like, write songs And basically, we take them away from the practice room. We'd record them on phones and things, and then we'd listen to them for a week. We'd all come back to the practice room, and then normally like 4 out of 5 people would go, well, I really hate these 4 sections. And it's like, this song only has 5 sections. What are we doing? It's like, yes, we're axing all 4 sections. And we just, so it's kind of the cutting room floor just got like, you know, just like covered in like stuff that we just discarded over and over again. And, but yeah. So we just kind of got really used to kind of writing together, and just, as I say, just kept on just coming back to it and back to it and back to it. And one of the things I think we talked about a lot was that you will listen to your own song before anyone else hears it. You will listen to it like 150, 200 times, like before it even gets to a studio, before you even start recording it. And then once you've recorded it and you're listening to mixes, you're going to listen to it another 100 times. Like, and then like, just because you want to, and you know, or you don't, you know, like, you're probably going to listen to it another 100 times before it gets released. So like, you need to be super clear that you love that song absolutely, with every second of it needs to be perfect to you, because it'll bug you forever, right? And so we used to just keep going over and over songs and just picking bits apart and just being like, take that bit out, no, I don't like that. We also like tried a bunch of stuff on that record, and I think Luke will agree with me on this, is that we just didn't know what we had like at the time. And think we kind of had something where we were like, do you know what, we have really enjoyed this, like we've really enjoyed this process. We've got something really nice, like something that like we can be really proud of ourselves. But it was just kind of shouting into oblivion for us. Like, nobody really knew who we were, like outside of our local towns, like really, like. And but we kind of said, look, okay, we're going to just like chuck a bunch of money into this, and we're just going to accept the fact that that's lost money. But we want to go into a proper studio, record it properly. Like, it deserves to at least, you know, have a proper producer and proper studio. So we did it, and then. Yeah, so we kind of just ended up with Oz sort of giving us back the first. We recorded it in 2 halves. That's right, isn't it? We didn't have. I don't think we either didn't have enough money. There was a reason.
It was purely financial.
It was money. That was it. We didn't have the money to pay for the studio block in 1 block, and so we actually paid for 1, recorded the first half of the album, and then our producer had to go and work out everything that we did on the first half, and then match all the settings. You'd never know, but it was perfectly knitted together, and that's what also makes Oz a genius yet another reason.
I couldn't tell you with any amount of certainty which are the 6 we did in the first session and which are the 5 we did in the other one.
I want to say it's how the album split, but I don't think that's right. I think you're right. I think we ended up with
I'm not sure it is, but I do know that Nameless was recorded last. I remember that because it was written last because we were due in the studio in 2 weeks and we didn't have the last song on the album. I was like, none of the songs we've written so far are good enough to end the album. We need something big. We need a good closer, and we had nothing. And then it somehow in the last 2 weeks we scrabbled our best song together. I have nothing to correct. I think Mark is broadly accurate.
Yeah, broadly. We got him, guys.
I would say something happened with me for sure, like in the few years that led up to that, because like the album took about 3 years to put together, but kind of like in the first year, so around like 2015 to 16, I wrote an album's worth of songs. Like, I had about 14-15 songs, a bunch of them like finished, a bunch of them sort of still work in progress, and a bunch more ideas, but I had like a shitload of stuff. And we booked this whole it's at some point in 2016, I think summer, we booked a whole weekend. We were just going to go into the rehearsal studio, hammer through the songs, like do some rewrite, and let's go, go, go. And the first one, we ended up wasting most of the first day on one song that eventually, after about 6 hours, we went, this is shit. We can't do this. This is absolute shit. And it was really, we kind of got dejected, but what came out of that first session, thankfully, was what became in Treatment. I remember that, but it sounded very, very different.
I remember this story.
There's only one
part of that song now that was kept from that original writing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know the da 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 da. That rundown that's part of that song is the only thing that's left. Is that genuinely was? And when I say literally, we were just cutting bits out and just like people going, "No, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it." And everyone's got a voice in the room. So if anyone goes, "Nah, I don't really like it," it's like, "Okay, cool, let's rewrite it, let's go for it again." It was never anyone just convincing somebody else that like we're going to keep it or something like that, unless somebody kind of was like, you know, that's perfect for me. Like, I think that's perfect. But like, yeah, generally speaking, it's always a pretty democratic process. But yes, In Treatment is literally just that da 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 da. That's the only bit that was left. And I seem to remember we hammered it as well. I think the first time we wrote it, like, we put it into the song like
about 10 times. We're like, this is a really great bit, keep putting it in.
I think that was part of the other thing with the writing stuff as well. We started to also realize that, like, and what we love about music, right? And I think like plenty of people have spoken about this before, like in music generally, is that the bits that you love in songs, like, are those very unique drum fills that happen once, like they don't happen 20 times, or, you know, that riff that somebody plays like in, you know, in the back of a song and you just hear it once, like in the record, or a band does something. And like, that's one of the like special things about music to me. And I think we started to realize that. And that's why we've done it a lot on every record, is like, right, what makes this song unique and special? Like, what's the bit, you know, okay, we're going to just do a weird time change, like just here, just once, just to go out of this verse into this chorus, like, and just making something a bit special out of it, so it's not just verse chorus middle eight done kind of thing, you know.
Yeah,
it's so yeah, we started to think a bit more about the structure of stuff and how to play around with it, which again, we learned a lot with Broken, and then we got to the next one and we were just like, cool, right, okay, like, it was just like a playground, because we were all just like, cool, like we actually like learned something last time, we could like do something all right maybe.
Yeah. I think, yeah, that speaks to the point I was gonna make actually, which was like, at some point I think after that session, basically we all realized our standards were higher than anything we'd previously had our names attached to. So we just tried to write songs we all really enjoyed, and so we kind of set that bar. And like Mark said, I remember the conversation about Broken. We were like, if we ever make our money back, like ever, on that first record, we'll be happy. And then by Christmas, we'd made it back. We were like, oh shit, this might actually be all right. but like, because Broken had come out and it'd been so well received by the people that had heard it. I mean, you know, comparatively speaking, it's still a very kind of niche album in a very niche genre. But that was our standard, and so we didn't want to put anything on something else that wasn't as good or better than Broken. And so that's like where the new records come from. We're like, we've just been setting our standards higher and higher for ourselves and making ourselves work, you know, 10 times as hard to try and get everybody as excited about the songs as
yeah.
Like, and it doesn't even have to take somebody to say, no, I don't like that section. It will be somebody just going, eh, it's fine. Like, fine is, that's a death sentence for a verse or a chorus. Like, that's absolutely in the bin. There's genuinely a song. I was thinking about this today. There's a song on this new album, that I made the mistake of writing it in its entirety, like minus the brass. I would never do that anymore. I used to write brass lines, and guitarists don't know how to write brass lines because they forget that brass players need to breathe, and so there's never any gaps. It's just like, no, 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 no.
Can confirm.
There's a song on the new album. It was, as far as I was concerned, like the intro, the hook, the verse, like pre-chorus, bridge, like everything's kind of done. I know it's going to take some rewriting, but everything's kind of there. Not one of the sections survived. And it still ended up with the same name, but it was kind of out of stubbornness in the end, because I didn't want to say, well, this is now a different song entirely, but literally nothing survived because people would just go, ah, I'm not fussed about that. So we'd rewrite that. And when that sounds great, then the other stuff kind of, you see how average that is. And you're like, oh, shit. Okay, maybe we should rewrite the verses. All right, do that. And then before you know it, this the song isn't a 5-minute epic. It's now like a 2.5-minute banger with very, very, very different sections. But yeah, for when the album comes out, if you're listening, track 7, it was a very, very different song.
We'll be right back after this.
Well, you mentioned All My Nameless Friends from the 2018 record.
Yeah.
Does that still your like closer?
Yeah, because what else do you close with?
Yeah, you have to close with All My Nameless Friends.
I think we've talked about it a lot, and the because of the way we finished that song with everyone just singing the woes with us, is if you play it like, you know, third or in the middle of the set, like, I mean, I think we have done it once. We've tried it once. We played it third. So our very good friends in Pope's Chili Town just said, do you know what? Just once, just drop it third and see what happens. And genuinely, we played it third, and everyone went, "Oh, that's weird. They must have cut Malcolm's set short." Like, and people, I think, started sort of moving to the bar, and then we started playing something else. They're like, "Oh, all right, okay, this is weird." Like, so, it didn't really land how we wanted it to land. We've also, like, I think, we've always had that thing about like, oh, like if we write something better to close a set, like we'll play that, like, and then we'll just work out the problem when we get there. But we've never really successfully found something else, something to do the job. So, yeah.
So in the song, you reference New Cross in Popes of Chili Town, B Sharp Productions. Who else are you referencing in that song?
It was the scene as it looked in 2018. So it's Barstool Preachers, Easy Dread, Millie Manders and the Shut Up are in there.
Leadshot Hazard,
Pisticables, King Pun,
Just Say Nay.
I mean, these are all like really great bands. So please do check them out. I mean, Just Say Nay very casually dropped like one of my favorite albums of all time the year after Broken came out. That's an absolute work of art. I think that's it.
So there's a scene. You guys are part of a scene at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's some of those bands aren't active anymore. Pisticables aren't, Just Say Nay aren't. A lot of them still are. But that was the scene. That was a snapshot of the scene in 2018. I mean, the song was actually Mark's concept. Like, I wrote it, but ran everything by him because it was his concept. This idea that we'd been playing all these shows at New Cross, in particular. And you see the same faces and you get very friendly with all these same faces. But at some point we realized that we barely knew anybody's names. Like we could drink for an entire evening with these people. They were like some of our best friends in the world, but we didn't know a lot of their names. That sounds more terrible than it actually is. Isn't it?
Yeah, we'll have to find a better way of telling this story. Like.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I get it. Like with ska bands, there's so many of us in a band. Like a small ska band is even like, what, 5 people? And
I mean, we are a small ska.
Yeah, right. But people. Like, even still, like, you know, a larger band, it's harder to know everybody's name. And if you know, you multiply that by how many bands are on the bill.
It's just like, it's the bands on the bill, but also like lots of the people that kind of come to New Cross as well. Like it's a big friendship group that's kind of just out of it. It's not everyone that's just, it's not just people playing. It's like.
I should have been specific. Not learning people, like the band member names, like that's another level of like, okay, just ask their name, dude. At a certain point, it's rude. We're talking about like the crowd though. We were just all these people in the crowd, like, we would just be so friendly with and chat with for ages. And just that at some point we realized that we didn't know a lot of their names, and they maybe didn't know our names, but like kind of in a poetically good way. I don't know how else to describe it. They're like family.
I'm really enjoying watching you dig. Just I'll dig my way out.
Give up. When would you say, so this scene at New Cross Inn, when did you really start to notice that there was this sort of active scene with bands and people coming to shows? And
people were going to ska shows. They just weren't necessarily there to see us.
I can actually say furthermore that they definitely weren't there to see us. We just were also there. But no, it's right. So, well, we just played the 15-year anniversary of B-Sharp, but it's kind of Paul and Mike running B-Sharp, and they just kept on putting on shows lots of the time at New Cross, and more and more people started sort of coming to the one place. It's kind of an interesting idea of like building a scene by making the place convenient. If that makes sense, just keep like keep attracting people to the one place, and just keep putting different bands on in that scene to the one place, rather than like saying I'm going to book all my favorite bands and it's going to be all over London, so that, you know, some people can go, some people can't. Just going, nope, like, I'm going to put it in New Cross, and then like, you know, I know now there are people. People that like we're really good friends with that are part of that scene that have just like moved closer to New Cross, like, because they're like, well, if I'm going to be here, like, you know, 5-6 times a month, I might as well like live closer to it. So like people have just like started to move their lives, and they're like, well, I might as well commute in the week because I don't really care about the job, but I really like ska music, so I'd rather be closer to New Cross. So yeah, so lots of people do that. So yeah, so it's a really like, that's kind of, I suppose, where it's come from, really. And yeah, say we've just sort of been playing on bills and like making friends with everyone like for a long time now. Yeah, very long time.
So B-Sharp are the ones that were putting on most of these shows?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much.
I can't remember the exact dates, but through most of the 2010s, I think, that because we, like Mark said, we just played their 15-year anniversary show, but they started somewhere some miles down the road. I won't get into specifics. You Americans, if I said like it's 20 miles down the road, you guys would be like, oh, so it's next door then.
It's only a 2-hour drive. What's the big deal?
But yeah, I did a different venue, but at some point they moved things to New Cross, and I want to say it was in or around maybe the time that or maybe a bit before Mark joined the band, I think. Don't know, but I should have a better B-Sharp history knowledge.
No, I think that's right, because I think actually we talked a lot about the fact of in the early stages when I joined, there was kind of this like we wanted to start getting on those bills, because we were sort of, you know, seeing bands play there a lot, and we were like, you know, sort of begging Paul and going, just put us on first. I don't care. Like, it's
give
fine.
Give us a show, mate.
Like, honestly, I'll just play before the doors open. Don't worry about it. It's fine. Like, just let me on.
And we have done that. Not at one of his shows, I should add. But yeah, we have been snuck on a bill before the doors open. Yeah, it's just Paul and Mike's like relentless love and enthusiasm for good fucking DIY music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And like, Scar is like is Paul's, you know, forever love. But it was just, I think you have to love it, don't you? Somebody's mm-hmm. got to. But no, you do. That with a genre like this, that's sort of, you know, it comes and goes. Those are what the waves are, right? It sort of comes back into consciousness and disappears again for another decade or so. at least kind of at the huge popularity level. But you have these absolute heroes underneath that just keep things alive and keep these scenes going. You know, Paul over here, and you've got
In Defense of Ska over here.
Yeah, exactly.
quite right.
But like you've got, we've been looking at, I've been gazing with envious eyes at your scene over there for years now, because you've got so many champions that just like, as much as Twitter is a hellhole, Scar Twitter is just a place that I can spend a cozy afternoon just scrolling through, like you guys all being so friendly to one another and posting like funny shit. It's like, there isn't that toxicity that you get anywhere else. It's just beautiful.
So you're playing some shows in the US later this year. Is that your first time in the US for Call Me Malcolm, or have you played in the US before?
First time playing.
First time.
Long time listener.
It is the third time we've tried to organize a US tour. And like, this time round, I was like, no, I'm not letting it go. I will not let it go this time. We are doing it. Like, we're absolutely doing it. So yeah, it's cannot wait.
Are you guys staying on the East Coast, or is it full US?
It is the East Coast for the time being. Yeah, this time round.
Okay.
As with many decisions we make as a band, it's all down to logistics and fitting things in with our adult lives.
Sure.
So yeah, we do an East Coast, and then obviously the dream would be to go hit the West at some point as well. But yeah, just East for now. Sorry, West Coasters, but we'll be back.
The further west you go, the longer the drives get.
We've been warned. Yeah, I think we needed to have a US sort of tour light. I think that was our first. And actually, I started to look at the drives on this one, and I was like, oh, this is just like a sort of nice little UK tour. That's a 3-hour drive. That's a 4-hour drive. Yeah, cool. These are all, some of these cities appear to just be overlapping each other. This is quite fun. I quite like this. And then I started to, we did get some offers for the kind of like the Midwest.
Western Midwest.
We kind of got this offer for Western Midwest, which was a wonderful tour and a wonderful offer. And the people that had offered it to us had worked very hard for it. So I should say that it wasn't that we weren't appreciative, and it wasn't to do with the drives. But I did start to navigate the drives and like just plotting out our routes and stuff. And it was a logical route. Like, and then as I started to say to Luke, I was like, I think he said something like, there's a couple of off days.
There's a couple of rest days. And in the UK, we're like, no, gig every day. And look at these off days.
Yeah. Mike was like, go and check your distances, boys. I mean, like that's a 10 and a half hour drive on a good day. Like,
there's no snow or ice or anything.
That's not a rest day. That is a drive day, and there's still a drive the day after that as well for your show.
Yeah.
So yeah, just East Coast. We need to be in the kiddie pool first before we do a grown up tour.
Yeah.
So you've played with some of the bands, the US bands in the UK, and you've been peeping on us as well, from what I can gather. what is your view? What is your take on the US scene versus the scene in UK right now?
Oh, don't do this versus thing. Come on now.
I'm curious. It's more like, I'm curious your take. What does it look like? I'm not asking you to rank them. I'm just saying, like, from your point of view, what does it look like to you? What does it seem like is happening here?
To be honest, Luke can have answered this as well, but like, I mean, for me, like, there's a real vibrancy to it at the moment. There's a real passion for it at the I've just noticed something different, like in the last couple of years. Like, there's something like really has changed fundamentally. I mean, if for no other reason, that, you know, when you just sort of look at pictures of gigs and stuff, and you're like, you know, when like pictures of bands are like really close, and you're like, yeah, okay, I think there were like 15 people at that show, like, and that's okay, that's fine. Like, those 15 people would have had an absolutely storming time. Get on with it, like, have a wicked time.
Just for the record, when when Mark joined the band, we would have killed for 15 people at our shows.
But there's something about like, and not just crowd shots and stuff like that, but there's just something about like the way people are interacting with posts like out in the US. And actually, we've noticed it as well when we started saying that we're coming over. Like, we've already got like people saying to us like, oh yeah, I mean, I'm coming to see you for like 4 out of the shows that I can make. Like, just so you know, I'm like, what? Like, you know, we can't get like our parents to come to 4 shows in this country, man. Like, what are you doing? But yeah, so it's there's kind of like the vibrancy of it and the response, certainly in the last couple of years, has just been really incredible. And I think actually the bands as well just seem really impassioned and just kind of, I say, with forgive the pun, with, but like riding the wave of it has been like just lovely. Like, you know, the bands are all hitting the road and actually going out and doing it. We're not just making records in our bedrooms and then releasing them into Spotify. We're actually going out and doing it, and like, you know, and just doing it over and over again. And because there's a love of it. Like, and so yeah, there's something about the US as well. I think they're working so hard. Like, they're working really hard for it as well. Like, they are coming to the UK, they are going to Japan, like they're going to other places as well. There's like, yeah, there's just a real feel for it at the moment. That's my take anyway.
Well, we're putting them up, but I think there are a few less barriers to US coming here than there are us going there. Logistical barriers, I think. We'll call it paperwork and we'll leave it there.
Is it easier to come to the UK than the US?
As a touring musician,
yes. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah. But it's just to add to what Mark was saying, I think aside from anything else, everyone's just putting out really fucking great music. Like albums and EPs and stuff, and like you can't have a thriving, vibrant scene if everybody's putting out shit. I think just everybody just seems to have been, particularly within the last few years, just been like at the top of their game, releasing like really good and interesting records. Like, it's not just a rehash of the kind of late 90s scene or anything like that. Like, everybody seems to really be bringing something different to the ska pot, you know, whether it's like Joystick or We Are the Union or Best of the Worst or Flying Raccoon Suit. Holy crap. Just been listening to their new album as well. It's just, there's so much good stuff out there. But then over here, you know, like Popes of Chili Town have been pushing the boundaries with their new record. That's a good scarcore record. Random Hand, one of my favorite bands, if not my favorite. Like, their new record is just unreal. But like I said, like, just everybody releasing good stuff, you know.
Call Me Malcolm.
Never heard of it.
No. We have a running joke because before our albums come out, like, they've been in our pockets for a while. Because releasing stuff obviously takes time. So we had this album in a finished version like some point last summer. And we're really proud of it. You know, it's the third. It's our third album. brackets fourth, and so we have it, and we're all super proud of it. And like, just from not even talking about from like guitar or vocals, like every other, I can look at all the other musicians on the album and singing stuff, and like, just everybody is just doing shit that I've never seen them do before. It's just unreal. And I think I've pushed myself as well on this album, but we've got it, it's in our pockets. And the running joke was, yeah, but we're the only ones that have heard it. What if it's shit? What if we're just idiots?
And that still remains to be proved. We're still all sitting there secretly cacking ourselves going, yeah, it could be shit. we've just listened to it a lot. That's not the same as being good.
we here at this podcast did get an advance copy from Mike Szczesinski.
Ah,
and I'm gonna say that it is Very good.
Bless you. Thank you. I was expecting you to just kind of go, it is okay.
An album.
it is that pause. That pause before you said very good. That was absolute.
Oh my.
Bullet to my chest.
Oh my heart. God. Oh, make that gap longer in the edit as well. Really, really string that out. Oh dear. Well, thank you. No, bless you. Thank you. That's incredibly kind of you to say. Thank you.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
I was a big fan of your last record, Me, Myself, and Something Else. This record you put out, like, was it like a month or two into the pandemic?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
we did.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a lot of conversations about that. We were so lucky. We were so lucky as well. I think it was just before the first lockdown was properly announced in this country. I think it was something like 2 weeks. It was something, wasn't it? It was like 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks. We filmed all of the videos, like, and they were all done. Broadly from the sort of point of view of like the work that we needed to do. Obviously, when you do the release cycle and everything, you've got like loads of work to do in terms of like there's just computer stuff to do, right? But you can just all do that at home. But all of like the physical stuff of us needing to be together, like shooting videos and all that kind of guff, was the last weekend. It was something like 2 weeks before lockdown, and it was just by complete happenstance that like we had it all done and recorded, and everything was then just give it to video editors and various other people to just do at home, and we had long conversations about it, didn't we, about whether to release it.
I think we shot the videos in February. I think it was February, and then we went into lockdown in March, but still it was weeks, so we'd done everything, but we'd already earmarked the release for May, and so we're in lockdown and everything. We had long conversations about whether we pull it or whether we just send it out and it is what it is, because at that point, like early pandemic, no one knew when it would finish. Obviously everyone was
3 weeks.
Just 3 weeks, you know, this will be over. And it's not like, I mean, by that point, by May, it was very, very clear that the world was on fire, and it was going to take a long time for everything to get back to normal. But you know, we were in that fortunate position where we had everything. We had all the assets. We had the album. We had the videos and stuff. And like Mark was saying, everything else is just admin. So we just decided to release it because why not? I've known bands that have done that did the other thing that kind of kept hold of their release. I know bands that were halfway that would almost finish recording at that point and didn't get round to finishing it until 2 years later.
Yeah, we talked a lot as well about, because of not being able to tour the record, and the kind of one of the deciding factors was that if it was just us that couldn't tour, we wouldn't have released it. But actually, because we actually kind of also talked about, like, we suddenly got a captive audience, like literally captive. Yeah. Like everyone's literally at home and the only thing they can do is consume the arts. And that's what we all did, right? Like I went through entire discographies of bands that I always said to myself, one day I'll do this. And I was like, well, I've now got 2 years of time on my hands. What the hell else are you going to do? And so I did it. And so we talked a lot about kind of just, taking advantage of trying to make the best of a situation, not taking advantage, sorry, like trying to make the best out of a situation. The response was incredible. I mean, we worked with Wiretap Records for that release. Who remain wonderful, and we keep discovering bands on that record label and going, hey, this band is great. I mean, I kept on recommending bands to Luke and then realizing they were our label mates, and I was like, I'm not sure this is not sure. I feel like I should do more research, so I kept on scrolling to the bottom and going, huh, Wiretap again, cool. Those guys were lovely and really, really helpful in terms of sort of putting our name out into the US properly, kind of for the first time. We had some people that had like heard us from Broken, but it was Wiretap kind of helped to push on that journey a lot more. It's just nice. So,
shout out to Jer from Scartune Network, who was shouting our name when Broken came out.
Yeah, they were.
So we'd had people recognition's not the right word, but we'd had some people kind of like saying, check these guys out. But once you've got the kind of legitimacy of a US label, there's something a bit more to it. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe perhaps I'm overthinking it, but yeah. We did decide to release a record in a pandemic.
Sorry, would you like these answers? I feel like do you want these answers to be shorter? Because we can definitely make these answers shorter if you need us to. I realize that you kind of ask us a question. We talk for 20 minutes and then we sort of go, oh, I'm sorry, what did you ask me again?
That's like, the show.
Sorry.
You also got the benefit of being like one of the first interviews of this release cycle as well. So we've got a bunch lined up, but you're getting the nobody's spoken to us in 4 years. Here, have all this information.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Few weeks, a few more of these, it'll be like, he released an album in a pandemic. Like, yep, cool.
Yep, cool.
What's next? What else you got?
Give Aaron a ring. He'll tell you everything.
I know some musicians felt like it was a bad idea to release music in the pandemic because they couldn't tour, but I felt like people, if you put out a good quality record and the record stood on its own, that it was a good time to put it out. Like, yeah, you weren't touring it, but people were like listening to it probably in a way maybe they wouldn't have been able to. So I don't know. I didn't see it as a bad thing releasing music in the pandemic.
No, I mean, just it was what it was, right? Everybody had to kind of adapt, and as Mark said, like nobody was touring, so it wasn't. I think we'd look very different as a band if we'd held on to it for a couple of years. I don't think we'd be where we are now.
It would have been so long as well. Like, I mean, kind of thinking about the timescale of it all now, I mean, we wouldn't have even, if we were really truly trying to wait until we kind of properly got out of it, I mean, we would have probably only released it like a year or so ago. Like, it probably wouldn't have been out that long. And so, the kind of timeline of things is that we certainly wouldn't be here with this one. Like, weirdly, I don't know. That's all ifs, buts, and maybes, and I'm just like,
yeah.
It's probably a stupid opinion, but that's mine, really. Like, we would have waited longer for Echoes and Ghosts, I guess. Like, and I'm pleased we didn't, because it's okay.
That very good. Aaron said it was very good.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. So, Luke, Broken was inspired by a specific breakdown that you had that you were processing and dealing with.
Yeah.
Me, Myself, and Something Else. Tell me a little bit about what inspired that record.
Well, that was, So I've been thinking about the kind of narrative of these our only three albums in existence. Yeah.
The only three, yeah.
Broken ends on this big high. This is what inspired Something Else. Broken ends on this big high, and the Nameless Friends ending. And it's like, it sort of gave this false impression, I guess, that I was fixed in some way. And I think in many ways at the time, I think I was, because I didn't expect at the time of this big breakdown that there'd be another one lurking, a bigger one lurking a few years later. And so I came out of that period, like, feeling very positive about myself, about like in my own mental health and physical health. And then I sort of stopped and looked around a bit and went, oh shit. Now I still have to exist. I have a name for what's going on in my head, but I still have to deal with the rest of the world. And that's what Something Else is really about. It's about, like, once you've looked inwards and figured some things out, how do you then kind of move on and cope in, you know, in a world that's on fire. Track two on the album was kind of written to set that up. What You Burn is about the 24-hour news cycle. And we very deliberately, the front cover, again, that's a Mark Bell special, was meant to be like, you know, the world as it is. But yeah, it was this post breakdown, like, yeah, I'm fixed. Wait a minute. This is hard to do. I hope that's succinct enough. I don't feel like that was as long as some answers we've given.
Do you mind if I ask, like, do you specifically struggle with depression and anxiety, or?
I have the trifecta. I have depression, anxiety, and OCD.
OCD. Okay.
Yeah. It's the magic triangle.
So when you talk about having a breakdown, are you talking about having like a depressive breakdown?
Yes. Yeah. That's basically it. It's like, you know, I from month to month, this is pre Echoes and Ghosts era Lucius. I was used to having every month maybe two or three days consecutively where I'd just go and I'd feel horrendous. And it would be like, it's a struggle to get up. It's a struggle to get dressed. It's a struggle to, you know, those sort of typical, well, I say typical again, I thought all this shit was normal. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. So if you're listening and you have episodes like that and you think it's normal, please talk to somebody. What was the question? No, I'm kidding. So every month I have these kind of these bits, and then the broken breakdown was just a period where it just wouldn't go away. There was no upswing. It was just every day until eventually did something about it. And it was like, once you're in something that low, that's a hike to get out. That's not just a wait for it to pass. That's you need professional help and self-care to the nth degree and that sort of thing. So, it's depressive, but there's a sort of spiral effect with my stuff as well. So I talk about the trifecta, 'cause OCD and anxiety are wonderful bedfellows. Here, you're anxious, you can worry about something. If you've got OCD, that fucking worry doesn't go away ever. but yeah, sorry. That's just a yes answer next time, Lucia. Just a yes. Is that a depressive episode? Yes. Next question.
So the anxiety and the OCD, they sort of like interact with depression, basically.
Yeah, it's all just a big big mental health soup, for want of a better description, and it's just simmering away.
One of the standout tracks to me on Me, Myself, and Something Else is what's it called? Please Try?
Please Still Try.
Please Still Try, thank you.
Yeah.
Can you speak on that song?
That's another Dead Men Take No Pills. That's another hide the darkest shit under the up-tempo stuff. I will take this public forum to shout out Chris Gethard, the New Jersey comedian who had a book called Please Still Try. And so that's my, what's the word? Homage.
Homage. We homage. Say homage.
Yeah, no, that dude, he's got a stand-up special called Career Suicide, which was one of those kind of life-changing pieces of artwork for me. I think that's so special. But anyway, that song is... there was a period of time on our scene where we knew at least two musicians who tried to commit suicide, and there was at least one, if not two, other people connected to the scene that tried and succeeded. And it was all within not a very long time frame. And having written an album like Broken and kind of dealing with this stuff like day to day, like in my own head, having those kind of things happen even relatively close to you is tricky to kind of process. So yeah, that song was kind of written from the point of view, I guess, of if I recall correctly, from fictitious, for almost like a character. I was just trying to highlight the fact that you never really know what's going on underneath. Like, somebody can seem happy and seem functioning. We don't play that song live, and so I'm struggling to remember any specific lyrics, but I remember writing it and going, trying to be as honest as possible, like when you're trying to cover this kind of stuff up, but from that more kind of catastrophic point of view, like that the really kind of critical point in someone's headspace where they are considering that. But yeah, that's Please Still Try.
So then that brings us to the new album, which we talked about at the beginning of the episode. But I mean, we really kind of discussed, you know, what went into it. But I know just reading other interviews you've done, you've referred to it as being quite a journey. I assume that the journey you're referring to is what you've already said about the record, about, you know, giving medication a try and what that's been like for you.
Yeah, partly. Aside from anything as well, at this point in our lives, we're all older and deeper into our adult responsibilities, we'll say. So like, keeping this shit going, like being in a band when it's not your full-time everyday job, like, it is hard. And so in the time since the last album came out, like I have a kid now. Lewis, our trombone player.
Our Lewis.
I couldn't remember the word for trombone. There, I said it.
I know, I just wanted to hear you say it out loud. Slidey pop up.
Yeah. He's got four. The triplets were born just after something else came out, 2020.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's how he ended up with four.
That's how we ended up with four. Yeah. So yeah, we can talk about this publicly. We've talked about this before in on stage and stuff. But yeah, that's why he, generally speaking, doesn't come out on the road with us, because four kids.
Sure.
So he plays. He generally plays local shows, and occasionally can come out. But yeah, I mean, Lewis writes along with Mark. Like, is. They write all the brass lines, but Lou does like all the scoring. He records like demo. He does a lot of stuff for us behind the scenes.
Absolutely. Sort of. Yeah,
he's early production work, basically.
Yeah, so all of the demo work, and then just
And so yeah, balancing all these things with children, and as I say, everybody is that much older. Like, you know, they have careers, and Mark's quite an important person where he comes from. And
he's not. He's really not. But bless you for saying that. But yeah, no. But yeah, we have all just got like lives and careers and various other things going on, like everyone else does. You know. We work really hard. I mean, I don't often say this, but I think it is kind of important, I think, to kind of to recognize. And actually, a bit like I was saying before about like Luke and I pushing each other, like we kind of know when to push and when not to push, but like we still have these like the some of them are stupid dreams, but like we just have like a list of stuff where like, and each time we achieve something, we're like, right, cool, what's the next one? Like, what's the next one? What do you want to do next? Like, what? So I mean, at the moment we've got some, we have like plans and stuff that we've got of like places that we want to play. So like over here, I don't know if you would have heard of it, but there's like Slam Dunk Festival over here. Like we'd love to play Slam Dunk one day. We're talking about so we tend to go to Download Festival, which is, I know, is a metal festival every year, but they have like a punk and like alternative stage, and like one day we're kind of desperate to kind of play the Avalanche stage and just kind of say, yeah, like we did that. And and yeah, so we kind of just like got dreams like that where we just sort of think, oh, you know, let's just push it. Let's just do the next thing. But yeah, it's starting to become more and more work to do those things and achieve them, right? So like you're kind of going, okay, cool. Like, so we're saying, oh yeah, I want to like go and play in the US. And then like, I've now come to the realization that actually whilst you're playing in the US is great, I don't know anyone, so I have nowhere to sleep, and I don't have any equipment, so I have to basically re-tech our band out again. I'm like, oh God, what have I done?
We're going over as five individuals and starting a new band over there, aren't we?
Yeah.
From scratch. We got nothing. We got nothing.
Don't worry. Somebody will take care of you. I know it.
This is why I've been so nice about the US ska scene. Like, please take care of us when we come over.
No, I jest as well, actually, because we are quite a long way. I am quite a long way down the road in terms of the planning and organization for the tour now. And one of the things I would definitely like to say kind of on the record is that I haven't met half the people I'm emailing, and the kindness and the love that just comes out of every person that I'm interacting with. I'm like, and they're like offering houses to me and, you know, like sorting out like accommodation and, you know, sorting out instruments and, you know, helping us with like various things, you know, drivers and routings and all the rest of it. And like, it's just, it's really touching, like really touching, like the kindness of people that yeah, you just don't know, like, and that kind of level of trust that they place in us as well, which I just think is it bewilders me. Like, it bewilders me that anyone outside of like my house wants to listen to my band, let alone people that are in a completely different area of the world. It's just like it continues to amaze me, and I will say it all the time, it continues to amaze me to this day. I absolutely adore it. Like, I can't tell you what it feels like to have somebody come and sing our words at us or sing along with our brass lines and things, and then to kind of go to other countries and then people do that too, and they're already wearing our merch when we get there. I'm like, that just, it blows my mind. Like, it blows my mind, and it will always continue to blow my mind. It's one of my favorite things about doing all of it, is just that response from people. So yeah, I'll complain about all the spreadsheets, and I'll complain about all of it, and Luke will listen to all of this complaining for many, many months until we hit the road, and then we'll go and do it, and I'll be all right. I'll be quite nice, I think. Like, I'll be all right.
Hell yeah.
So I got two short questions, then we'll end the interview.
Oh, we will make them long.
Okay. Hey, do what you want with these questions, you know. I'm just going to lay the questions out and you guys can go off. It's fine. Are we referring to you as post-ska core?
Oh,
is this your,
man.
Is this your genre?
Is this your short question?
I read that there was a campaign that you had to be post-ska core.
I can't remember when I publicly used that phrase. So bless you for digging. That's a deep cut. That's been a running joke in the band for a couple of years. And I say that in an interview or something?
Yeah, you would have done.
You did.
I actually put it
into the wild because I've been joking about us being post-ska core. Look, okay.
If you want to claim it,
no.
You can do it now.
No,
if you don't
no, we
it,
don't.
Okay. Luke, this is your moment. This is your moment. You're like, I'm going to make this a thing. I'm going to make it a thing.
Millions of people will listen to this interview. So here's your chance.
I'm going to say no, we're not. We're not. Because because eventually I ran the idea past intellectually it makes sense, our influences and stuff, like it is a correct phrase for our genre, however it makes us sound like fucking asshole. So no, we are not post-scarcore, but also we kind of are. And also I invented the term post-scarcore TM.
Pick a lane, man.
But also, no, we are ska punk. We are ska punk.
Oh, man.
No, in the... It's
an inconclusive answer that is not helpful.
half seriously, in the end, I did think suddenly labeling ourselves as a new genre, it sounds like really ungrateful to the ska punk community that has gotten us this far in the first place.
Yeah, it does sound like we're about to kind of reinvent ourselves with just a cymbal and ask for that to be added to the keyboard. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not right.
Here's the final question. Another little tidbit from an interview. Trev, our bass player, cannot blow a medium-sized raspberry. He can do it small and big, but medium is an impossibility. Okay. Can you explain to me what this means? I have no idea what you're talking about.
I love that that's the final question.
You don't know what blowing a raspberry is?
No, I do not.
So that's like, what blowing a raspberry is?
Yeah.
This is great audio content.
Yeah.
What is a medium raspberry? Does that mean just the intensity level?
Well, as in it's kind of, I think it's kind of broadly like how far the tongue is out of the mouth, I think is so like if is a small one, and because the tongue's like only a little. I can't believe I'm sitting explaining this. But basically, he has a tongue piercing. Or he had. I don't know. Has he still got it?
I haven't looked recently.
I haven't checked Trev's tongue recently. I'll need to go, like, thank you. I'll put it in my phone to remind myself to check Trev's
check
tongue.
Trev's tongue.
Yeah, just stick it. Hey Siri, can you put a reminder in for Trev's tongue tomorrow?
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
You all right then, Governor?
Ew, is this Adam or is this someone else?
Somebody from Britain. Come on.
Oh, okay.
That sounds like a fucking Australian person, I'm sure. You ever play that game though? My favorite game when we'd be on tour in the UK back in the day was to try somebody to talk with an American accent.
Now, see, I've never played that game, but I feel like people in England do better American accents than Americans do British accents.
Yeah, for sure. But they all sound Midwest. They all sound like they're from the Midwest.
Midwest or Southern.
Yes.
Why is it? Okay, so British actors, if you're listening, why don't you ever try to access the Californian accent? Just listen to our podcast and you'll get a nice breakdown of the Californian accent. Yeah.
Use this as a primer. And if you need more, you can always head over to our Patreon. Listen, you can head over there and hear longer interviews with each one of these guests. You mm-hmm. can hear bonus material. You can be supporting this podcast, something that we really appreciate.
Yes.
We do this. We put this out every week for free. But if you got a little bit extra money, boy, oh boy, we would really appreciate your support.
Boy, oh boy. Yeah. I mean, I get really Californian in there too. So if you're a British actor, you should definitely sign up to the Patreon.
Yeah, for sure, dog.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.